Hey everybody, you are listening once again to F This Movie! My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of Michael Mann's Heat by the heatest guy I know, Alex Lawson.
I'm wondering if it's too late for you and me to make a decision to do this entire podcast as Robert De Niro and Al Pacino.
Who would you prefer to be?
Well, I think you're dealing with a hell of a film here. No, I'm kidding.
You gotta buzz in it. Give me all you got!
Give me all you got! That's, yeah.
She's got a great ass!
So basically, we're both gonna be Al Pacino, and this is going to be.
Up in it. I'm gonna keep
Don't
going.
Waste my motherfucking time, Patrick, because.
Heat. Anyway, you're listening to this movie. You can find all of our past episodes, plus reviews, columns, and more daily material at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. You can listen to us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdictpresents.com. And as always, visit dvdverdict.com for tens of thousands of DVD and Blu-ray reviews. If you're listening to us talk about a movie on the show, you want to see it, you decide to purchase it, check out dvdverdict.com, click on the Amazon link, and buy it that way. Support DVD Verdict for supporting F This Movie.
Absolutely.
And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm never shy about making light of our multitude of internet presences many platforms. Has there been a podcast-wide policy decision on whether or not we are on Instagram?
I believe we are, just as soon as someone tells me what Instagram is.
Yeah, I would imagine we would post pictures of like you and Doug watching movies.
Yeah, but they would look kind of old timey and vintage, right?
Well, that's up to you. If you want to employ a filter, you can.
I want my life to look like a Tim Burton movie.
I'm
just kidding. My life is shitty enough. As much as we joke about like, and I'm tired of doing the spiel. Like, here's the 10 places you can find us, right? But meanwhile, like. We're actually only on like kind of the main ones because it's not, I don't know how to dig something with two G's. I don't know what stumble on is.
Stumble upon. Those aren't like
stumble
social.
Upon, sorry.
Those aren't like, those are like methods for sharing content more so than like communities you join. But
I barely understand chat rooms.
All right. Well, you should watch. There's a great movie called You've Got Mail.
Okay. And that's the movie where Meg Ryan makes typing faces, right?
It was the inspiration for what we now know as the internet.
Okay. I like that movie against my better judgment, but it is hard to watch Meg Ryan make typing faces like so that we know exactly what she's thinking with every line that she types. Like, this is a happy line. I smile. Now I'm quirky and inquisitive.
It doesn't help that Hanks is like running a clinic on computer acting opposite her. Like that doesn't help. I mean, she just looks ridiculous.
That movie's on TNT a lot and I will watch it. We're going to talk about what we've seen lately, but before we do, there were two things that we wanted to talk about sort of more movie news related. You had an item, but before you get to that, I want to give a plug. I just found out our Facebook friend, Alexa, who actually worked on the movie The Woman that I've talked about, written and directed by Lucky McKee. It was on my list last year of my 10 favorite movies. There's a review of it at fthismovie.blogspot.com. A great, great, great horror movie. And she just posted – she actually found us through the review. She worked on the movie. I think she was a stuntwoman. She just posted that it is now available on Netflix Instant. So if you've heard us talk about it, you're interested in seeing it, you want to give something really great and original a chance, check out The Woman on Netflix Instant.
I certainly will, and everyone should follow suit.
Yes, and now, Alex, you had something that you wanted to talk about as well.
I did. I sent you a while ago, a couple days ago, an article from the New York Times. It's a very highly regarded news publication, as I understand it.
Sure. They may or may not be my employer. So I'll say I love the New York Times.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Company man. It was an article about Paul Thomas Anderson's upcoming movie, The Master. And when I read it, I realized I should be reprimanded because I am in like dereliction of duty as a Paul Thomas Anderson fan. I had heard about The Master. Mm-hmm. I knew that it was rumored to be something of a veiled criticism of the origins of Scientology. But as far when last I had heard, it was like stuck in development hell. But when I, you know, when I read this New York Times piece, I found out it has a release date. And furthermore, that release date is this year, yeah, in October.
I don't think that's completely solid yet.
No? Okay.
I mean, everything that I've heard up until that New York Times article, which certainly makes it sound a little bit clearer, but everything I've heard is like, yeah, it's shooting and we think it might come out this year, question mark,
right,
you know?
Right.
So yeah, if it's not late this year, I'm sure it'll be early next year. I don't know.
I had no idea it had a green light, which is an industry term for green light.
It was put together and was ready to start shooting, and I believe the financing fell through because a studio got cold feet. I think that's actually a little bit that's maybe not totally confirmed because
nobody
would really
about,
go on the record as to like why did it fall through, and nobody would really say. And Paul Thomas Anderson like does zero press these days, so he is just
sure,
like a hermit.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, it was a. Yeah. My point is, I found it to be a very interesting piece, and maybe we can link it or something when we put this up. We're giving Paul Thomas Anderson the rubber stamp treatment. This is like, we will wait until you let us down. Like, I will give you the benefit of
every doubt.
Not that I even have any doubts, but just the notion of, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman as any sort of charismatic cult leader.
Right.
You can sign me right up.
And now Jeremy Renner was originally in the movie in sort of its original incarnation. And then when it kind of fell apart, you know, he took 8 more jobs because he's in a lot of movies.
Well, he's on the fast track to the between the Avengers and the next, and then the Bourne franchise.
Right.
I mean, like, he is like poised to be the next like big action star.
Yeah,
him and Taylor Kitsch are on the. They're gonna do all the road shows.
Taylor Kitsch, who the Onion AV Club described as a human air guitar solo. Jeremy Renner fell out, and he's been replaced by Joaquin Phoenix. But
in his first like legit. As is pointed out in the New York Times piece, I think his first like real role since his maybe fake meltdown, is that right? Or maybe I made that up.
Yeah, I don't think he's been in anything since I'm Still Here, and I don't even remember the last thing he was in before I'm Still Here, to be honest.
Yeah, right.
No idea. Nothing. Gladiator? Anyway. Parenthood. I believe it was Parenthood.
It was.
So we're excited about the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, is your point.
Check out that piece if you haven't already.
Yeah, I will try and remember to link to it in the article in the podcast posting, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Sometimes before we record these podcasts, I listen in iTunes because I have iTunes. Yeah, be jealous. To some pieces of movie music, and I heard 2 right before we started recording. And you need to advise me. One was that music that plays, I believe the piece is called Time by Hans Zimmer. It plays at the end of Inception.
And
it made me really, really want to watch Inception again.
When he's deplaning at the airport.
When he's deplaning. So I need to watch Inception again. But the other one was a piece of score by Daft Punk from the soundtrack to Tron Legacy, a movie I did not like. But it made me want to watch Tron Legacy again. Have you seen this movie, and can you advise me as to whether or not I should revisit Tron Legacy?
I mean, no. No, you should not. There's nothing for you in Tron Legacy. If you like if the music made you want to watch it, I would advise you to just keep listening to the soundtrack. The soundtrack is the best part of Tron Legacy.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing about music in movies. You can listen to it independently of having to endure
the movie again. It's the piece of music that was in the original, that great like trailer. And I was so I was so excited for that movie. The trailer seemed like it was cool, and the music was cool, and I was like, "Look, they can fix all the stuff that was wrong with Tron." And that didn't happen.
Well, what you're doing is, I mean, you're setting yourself up to experience this cycle of emotions all over again. You know, I mean, my very sincere and serious answer is, if you're compelled to do so, you should watch it again because you have what is the name of the column you do where you give things a second chance?
Take 2.
Yeah, there you go. Take 2.
Yeah.
How did I not connect that. How did I miss? Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not going to be so pompous as to say, hey, don't ever watch Tron Legacy again. Yeah, do it if you want. I don't know. Maybe you'll pick something up. I don't think I will.
I used to do this with Cherry 7-Up all the time. I would wait a year and then I would be like, I should probably try Cherry 7-Up again. I can't remember if I like it or not. And I would try it and it would be not good. And then it would be another year or two before I would start to think I should try Cherry 7-Up again. You know, Tron Legacy is the Cherry 7-Up of movies. Alex, what... Or no, not what. What's the question I ask? Have you seen anything good lately?
I saw, in an attempt to sort of alleviate the name of a certain game we play sometimes, Movie Shame, I was inspired in part by the subject matter of Heat, which we're talking about, to watch the film Bonnie and Clyde, which I had never seen before.
All right.
And it's obviously not lost on me, and I've read all the articles about how much of a classic it is, and I said, well, I haven't seen it and I should watch it, and I watched it and I really liked it, but as soon as it was over, I could not shake this feeling that the my initial reaction to it was, even though that was a great movie and I enjoyed it, I realized that movie will never mean as much to me as it does to people who saw it the first time when it was, you know, originally released in theaters. And There's very little I can add to the intellectual discussion of Bonnie and Clyde. Like, I understand its significance for its depictions of sex and violence at that time. But I, in my, you know, 2012 jaded mindset, I'm bringing a whole different frame of reference to watching the movie. And so while I definitely enjoyed it and I'm glad to have watched it, it'll never... Like I said, it'll never really mean to me what it means to a whole other generation, and that's to its credit, actually. I think not taking anything away from it.
Yeah, it's hard whenever we watch some of like the classic movies now, having not seen them when they first came out. It's hard to always appreciate the impact. You know, it's been you've seen Bonnie and Clyde filtered down through so other movies and through so much other pop culture that it's like you've seen so many imitators that it's hard to now see the original and really appreciate it for what it is. Not that you don't, but it's like, yeah, it's hard to be really knocked on your ass by this thing that you've seen copied 100 times already.
This is why when I have children, I'm going to start them watching George Millet.
Yeah. You gotta get them to do it in order. And then they end at Tron Legacy. I would encourage you, though, to wait like maybe a year or two and watch Bonnie and Clyde again, which isn't to say that you disliked it in any way. I know you said you liked it, but I think repeat viewings will only help the movie. I think there are definitely some quote unquote classic movies that like, yeah, I saw, you know, Marathon Man. Marathon Man is not in the same league as Bonnie and Clyde, but Marathon Man is a movie that a lot of people like. And I saw Marathon Man, and you see it once, and I'm like, yeah, I feel like I got everything there is to get out of Marathon Man. I'm good. I can move on from Marathon Man. But Bonnie and Clyde is a movie that the more you go back to, I think the more you appreciate. And like you said, I know you've read a lot about it, but the more you know about Bonnie and Clyde and just how sort of transformative it was in 1967 will make you just appreciate the shit out of it. I mean, that's partially my relationship to, like, Citizen Kane. I don't necessarily watch Citizen Kane and, like, really enjoy myself watching it, but I'm just so transfixed by all the things that are going on in that movie that are so ahead of their time that changed movies forever that I can appreciate it on that level. Bonnie and Clyde to me works on that level, but it also works as like a crazy entertaining movie. There's a book that was written a couple years ago by Mark Harris, I believe is his name, called Pictures at a Revolution.
Yeah, that's like that. That's the one that's like about The Graduate and In the Heat of the Night.
It's about the Best Picture race of 1967, like the turning point in Hollywood where the generation gap was really apparent. If you have not read that book, there's a lot of great stuff about Bonnie and Clyde that can only serve to make you appreciate the movie more.
It is something that I will revisit. So yes. Thank you for recommending that, and I will do that.
I saw two movies that I'll talk about because, as I was saying before we started recording, I've been slightly derelict in my movie watching because I've been too busy watching a shitload of Cheers on Netflix Instant. I'm having a lot of problems talking today. The two movies I will talk about. One is in preparation for the new show Girls on HBO. I went back and watched Lena Dunham's movie Tiny Furniture from a year or two ago. It's on Netflix Instant. I did not love Tiny Furniture. It's sort of part of this mumblecore movement where everything is very realistic and navel-gazing and everyone is artistic and slightly pretentious. And I think Lena Dunham is fucking with that formula a little bit and is willing to say, like, we're a little bit full of ourselves and we all need to grow up a little bit, you know, her generation, especially sort of these New York kids of privilege, which she is. So it's interesting the way that her, and it's true of Girls also, the way that sort of her life informs her art, because I don't think she's surprisingly candid about how willing she is to sort of let her life be part of the story, you know, while she's not necessarily playing herself, she sort of is.
It's a proxy. Yeah.
The one thing I'll say about Tiny Furniture is that to me, it sort of recalled the mid 90s sort of Sundance boom, where movies like this were being made all the time and Parker Posey was in most of them.
Sure.
About just people
talking and
young hipsters not sure of their place in the world and where to go. And I have a great affection for that genre because that's right around the time that I sort of, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, sort of discovered this new kind of movie. It was more than just like what was playing at the mall. It's like, oh, there's all this other stuff too. And I would seek all those movies out. So I will always have an affection for that. And the fact that this movie is reminiscent of those in some ways scores at some points. But I can't say that I loved the movie. What I've seen of the show Girls so far seems to take what worked in Tiny Furniture and improve on that. So we'll see. Where the show goes from here, but
because I have not seen Tiny Furniture, but I have seen the first two episodes of Girls, and I really enjoy it. And I have sort of bookmarked in my head to revisit Tiny Furniture. I mean, if you were going a little bit, probably longer than we should at the upfronts here, but I mean, what exactly was it about Tiny Furniture that did not work for you? I mean,
it's
too self-important or
it's pretentious. I honestly part of the problem is the direction, and Lena Dunham wrote and directed and stars in it herself, and I don't know, did she direct the first two episodes of Girls? I honestly don't know.
I think that is the case.
Okay, well then maybe she's gotten better.
I could be wrong, and I'm sure people will tell us if we are. But,
yeah, maybe she's improved. I just, Tiny Furniture seems cold in some ways and just very unsure of what it wants to say, in that I think she has a lot of things that she wants to say, but she only sort of half suggests a lot of them. And so far, Girls seems to be a more refined version of her thesis, if that makes sense.
Okay. All right.
Is a movie I watched via On Demand, and that is Morgan Spurlock's new documentary, Comic-Con Episode 4, A Fan's Hope, which is a documentary shot at the 2010 San Diego Comic-Con. And unlike Morgan Spurlock documentaries of the past, he's not in the movie. He doesn't narrate it. He's not on camera ever. So that, I think, many will see as an improvement, people maybe who don't love Morgan Spurlock. I enjoyed the movie, because of course I enjoyed the movie. Like,
right,
it's people talking about the things that I like. I'm the target demographic. A lot of us at F This Movie are. A lot of people listening to F This Movie are the target demographic for this movie. So it's very entertaining. I think it has a lot of problems as a movie, not the least of which it seems to be one of the first documentaries that I've seen that seems to be really informed by the language, not of documentary filmmaking, but of reality TV. Oh. So much of it was sort of shot and cut the way like a reality show is. And that really started to bother me as soon as I noticed it, because I was like, well, this, this is going backwards. This can't be with the way things are going.
it can't progress on this way.
No, this is...
We've come from Nanook of the North to...
Right,
the,
we're learning all the wrong lessons. But also, you know, part of the problem is that it was shot at the 2010 San Diego Comic-Con when, by the way, Tron Legacy was going to take over the world. Things have changed.
Much more... These are far more mentions of Tron Legacy than I thought I was in store for, by the way. Keep going.
Things have changed so much even since 2010 in terms of Comic-Con and the San Diego Comic-Con, because that was really sort of the zenith, and that's interesting to see it in a movie, but there's no sense of contemporary context, which is to say all these people spend all this time in the movie talking about the geeks have inherited the Earth, and this is the biggest thing ever, and now all these major studios understand that this is the way to get audiences to your movie and blah 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 blah, but none of that is true, right? Because Tron Legacy spent a fortune building this display and nobody really went. Cowboys and Aliens does this big thing, nobody goes to see Cowboys and Aliens. Like, Comic-Con presence doesn't translate to box office, and studios are figuring that out to the point where last year, and partially because they are holding their own convention now, but Disney didn't even go, which means there was no Marvel presence because now they own Marvel.
Yeah.
And so you have, you know, typically they're sort of previewing the big geek property movies to come out the following year. And so last San Diego Comic-Con last year, 2011, like, is the year that realistically they could have had a huge Avengers presence, you know, or like Dark Knight Rises really could have been there. And none of these things were there because I think studios are realizing, well, we can spend a fortune to be at Comic-Con. And either no one will come, or if your Dark Knight Rises, like, why bother? Everyone's coming anyway. Like, you're going to go preach to the choir just for what, you know? So that's – I just feel like they sort of touch on these certain things. Like, there's a few mentions of this idea of, like, the tension that exists at the San Diego Comic-Con between the diehard geeks who are still in it for comic books and like the people who want to go to the Twilight panel. And that's been the big, that's what everybody talks about.
When you were describing it, I was wondering if that was addressed at all.
There's mentions of it. And there's definitely, you know, the guy who owns like Mile High Comics is a big figure in the movie. It sort of follows these four or five people. It doesn't really deal with like celebrities or whatever. It's like two guys who want to get their art evaluated and one girl who wants to win a sort of a costume contest. And this guy who owns this huge comics distributor, trying to see if people are still buying comics at the Comic-Con. And so, you know, they're good about another guy who wants to, propose to his girlfriend at Comic-Con. So like, it's good about selling these little human interest stories, but again, in the way that a reality TV show does. I don't know. That was distracting. So again, I like so much of what's talked about. I like seeing all the people on screen, but I think it's got a bunch of problems as a movie. I would still recommend it, especially if you're a fan of this kind of stuff.
Do you feel like the dynamic of the convention has changed so much, even in this narrow time since the movie came out, that like – you could do a whole like that it warrants like another documentary to do you think there's another movie to be made about this now? Do you think enough has changed?
I think maybe. I think especially going forward, and I think, you know, people don't really know what's going to happen
right
going forward. This weird, you know, where does geek culture belong? Isn't geek culture now just pop culture, you know? So I don't know if enough has officially changed, but it seems like it's changing. So yeah. I do wish that maybe he had intercut some of this with some more contemporary stuff. I don't know, but I feel like it feels dated and it's just now being released. So you have a movie that's
a problem. Yeah.
Currently in theaters that feels completely outdated already. I don't know. Anyway, that's what I've seen. Let's talk about Heat, because we've spent a long time talking about other stuff. Now, you had brought up the possibility of doing a Michael Mann movie because you – for real, I don't know if I'm having a weird diabetic reaction.
Smell the smelling salt,
nothing
guy.
Nothing is making sense. You were on a big Michael Mann kick, correct?
Sure was, yeah. I sure was, and I just – I don't – this happens to me sometimes – where I'll binge on certain directors or certain screenwriters. I went through a big David Fincher thing, like when I was like so obsessed with The Social Network. a few, you know, like immediately after Social Network came out. But I found myself sort of tearing through a lot of Michael Mann movies. And I mean, you were the one who suggested Heat of all the ones I gave to you. So yeah. I would sort of put it back to you in terms of, yeah, look out, in terms of, you know, what we I think we both were coming at it from a similar standpoint in that it's a movie. I mean, have you seen Heat a lot or
more than I? Surprisingly, yeah. And again, yeah, it's one of these movies that when TNT isn't showing You've Got Mail or Tombstone, they seem to show Heat. So I have seen it a lot because I do think it's very, very watchable. Like, you can kind of come in at any time, and it's pretty good. Like, and you don't even necessarily have to make it to the end.
No.
Because it's really long, especially with commercials. It's like 4 hours. I just felt like we maybe could have done a podcast on Collateral, but I didn't feel like there were a ton of other Michael Mann movies that either A, warranted their own podcast, or B, would have sort of the wide appeal of Heat. I think Heat is the movie that the most people have seen of Michael Mann's movies.
Let me tell you what I think of when I think of Heat, even before I watched it this most recent time. And actually, when I want you to know, as the showrunner here, I was tearing through all these Michael Mann movies. I watched Heat first like a month ago, and then I watched it again.
Nice.
In exclusive preparation for the podcast.
That's so, commitment. So, thank you.
It is commitment. The first thing that I think of when someone mentions Heat is one of the lamest adjectives that exists in our language, and that is the word big.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think of the word big is because everything about Heat just seems to be on such a grandiose scale.
Mm-hmm.
It has this great epic set piece around which, you know, the action of the movie is centered. It has two larger than life stars who weren't quite yet to the point of laughability in their like choices. If you look at both of the arcs of Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, I wouldn't say that this is like the last good movie that they both made. No, I mean, this is bad because I was just looking at this and I should have had this ready, but they both made some good movies since, but this was definitely like the start of their death rattle, I suppose. You know, something like that.
Right.
And furthermore, even beyond those things, like the filmmaking aspects, the story, like the whole point is that these larger than life personalities are driving both sides of this, what is a very simple story, really. And you can see right from the beginning that a certain, you know, collision course is in place. But at the same time, the movie, obviously, this isn't as true when you rewatch it, but I remember the first time I watched it. The movie raises the stakes in such a way that you really believe that either character could, to use a simple phrase, win.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily see, like, you can, and that's kind of rare, and that's pretty hard to do, especially for like a cops and robbers movie, right? Mm-hmm. To where any, like, you know, the bad guys could get away with it or the cop could catch him. And, you know, given the circumstances of each man's professional life and personal life, it is totally wide open. And this is not to say, before I push it too far in this direction, there is a lot of stuff that doesn't work in Heat. Michael Mann he really goes for it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff being thrown at the proverbial wall to sort of make certain characters more relatable, I think, or more human. That doesn't quite, and not all of it quite needs to be in there. I feel like maybe he doesn't quite maybe trust the simplicity of the story enough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking most specifically about most of the scenes with Amy Brenneman. and this is not to say that that is not a bad idea. Like, I understand that, you know, Robert De Niro plays Macaulay, this like career thief, and he has never had any sort of, you know, you're at least led to believe he's never had any sort of real connection to anything in his life. And that the point of Amy Brenneman's character is to, you know, give that he has something to lose. And that's all fine from a narrative standpoint, but I don't actually buy many of their scenes together. That's just one of my quibbles.
The thing is, it's this weird anomaly for me, because I agree with, you know, basically everything you just said, including the fact that the movie, I think, has a lot of problems, and that it's great. You know, Michael Mann is sort of this guy who's technically obsessed, not just in terms of filmmaking, where his movies are always very kind of technically perfect.
Yeah.
Except for Public Enemies. But he's interested in technique in terms of how to orchestrate a bank robbery. What are the steps that these guys go through to case a place out, to gather equipment, to do, you know, to gather intelligence? What is the procedure that the cops follow and while pursuing these guys? All that stuff is super, super fascinating. You know, where he gets messy is when, like you said, it tries to deal with the emotional side of things. Because I don't know, you know, Michael Mann is certainly not a sentimental guy or a sentimental filmmaker. And not that he ever tries to be sentimental, but it definitely runs into some walls, I think, when it tries to deal with emotions. And again, you could make an argument that, like, well, because these are characters who have trouble dealing with emotions. Okay, sure. But I think there's a difference between successfully showing your character struggling with this and your movie struggling with this. So he has problems. But it's this weird thing, because to me it's such an anomaly, because I'm willing to forgive. It's like I lump all the good and the bad in together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so willing to just be like, eh, it's Heat. Like,
yes,
it has everything. I don't know. It has everything. Do we need the subplot with, like, Dennis Haysbert as this guy who's recently released out of prison and is sort of trying to go straight? And then
that sticks out in my mind.
You know what I mean?
Like shoehorned.
Right. It's this weird, unnecessary subplot. And I kind of understand what he's trying to say, which is that, you know, the movie is trying to understand the psychology of some of these guys, the guys who are obsessive in their pursuit of this one thing, or obsessive in one area of their lives. You know, Al Pacino is obsessed basically with being a cop and winning and getting the bad guys. And Robert De Niro is obsessed. He's just focused. I won't say obsessed. He's very focused.
Yes.
So the movie's interested in the psychology of a very specific kind of male. Mm-hmm. I'll get into the problems that the movie has with women in a little bit. But so we have this Dennis Haysbert character who only gets a couple scenes in the movie, because a lot of people only get a couple scenes in the movie because there's just so many things to service. And he's, you know, this short order cook who's trying to go straight. And Bud Cort is his boss, and he's an asshole. And at one point near the, you know, during the bank robbery climax, and spoilers for Heat coming up, you can just assume that we'll be spoiling Heat from here on out. Robert De Niro loses his getaway driver, recognizes Dennis Haysbert, says, "Hey, you want to drive?" Dennis Haysbert thinks about it for a second, says, "Yes." And so, you know, I understand that Michael Mann is sort of trying to examine the kind of guy who doesn't know how to do anything else, who gave legitimacy a shot, but who only knows how to do this one thing, and how easy it is to fall back into these patterns that's all you know. But the movie...
I mean, that's the message, but, like, he doesn't have nearly enough, like, actual, either screen time or, like, stuff to do that would actually sell you on that from, like, an emotional standpoint, I think.
I do and don't agree. I mean, I agree that it is underdeveloped because so many of the things in the movie are. I think it does come across in just a short amount of screen time. My problem with that subplot, and this is something that happens kind of a lot in Heat, it gets fucked up because we have Bud Cort as his boss being this raging asshole who's basically stealing money from him and saying, like, okay, you have to give me a cut of your paycheck, otherwise I'll report you to your parole officer. And so to me, there's no choice. Like, Dennis Haysbert isn't really left with a moral choice. It's like, well, of course I'm going to get out from under this fucking asshole who's stealing from me and go back to being a getaway driver. Like, there's no decision there. And so I think that the movie undercuts its own conflict in a way. And again, Michael Mann is very obsessed with like interviewing guys who have these stories, former crooks, former cops.
Slavish attention to detail.
Yeah. Absolutely. And maybe he's talked to guys who were like, yeah, I got out of jail and I worked for these guys who would rip me off. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. I'm just saying I think it undermines the drama of the Dennis Haysbert character. Another problem I have with the Dennis Haysbert character is that when he does quit his job, he fails to say what, Alex?
When your employer is stealing money from you, we'll be there for you. That's all states stand.
I was looking for, fuck you, Jobu, I do it myself.
Oh, damn it.
But it was a good try. It was a good try. It was a good try.
I went the other way. Occurred to me when he crashes the car is a more appropriate time for that. And so I jumped the gun a little bit. But yeah, I do it myself.
But again, I accept it because I'm just like, it's Heat. I appreciate that the movie is trying to do so much. And when the movie works, I mean, it really, really works. Like, I really like the movie, even though I recognize it has a lot of problems. But the stuff that's good about it, I think, is really good. I really like Robert De Niro's performance. And it's fascinating because, again, the scene that gets talked about for some reason in Heat is him and Al Pacino in a diner having coffee because it's like, oh, these two great legends on screen together. And it's like,
come on. Well, I mean, don't act perplexed as to why people talk about the scene. Like, well, I mean,
I am a little perplexed. Like,
come on.
It's not a very good scene, first of all. I don't necessarily, it makes no logical sense in terms of the movie. It's shoehorned in just to get these two guys on screen together. You know, they should be talking about the bank robbery. But the reason that I bring up that scene is it's this great sort of study in the two approaches that the guys take to their characters. And I understand that it's the way that the characters are written.
You mean do you mean like the actor's approach,
yes,
you're saying?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Because
I know you meant the actual character. Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah. It's definitely, I mean, the way that the characters are written, but you have De Niro just underplaying everything, stone-faced. And you have Al Pacino throwing up pieces of his lung because he's acting like a crazy man. And I'm pretty sure it's Doug that has brought this up before, possibly JB as well, talking about A Few Good Men and that scene at the end where Tom Cruise is interrogating, I don't know if that's the right word, Jack Nicholson on the stand.
Cross-examining.
Yes, cross-examining, not interrogating. That's there not the right, that's not a legal term. And Jack Nicholson is basically just sitting there, you know, not doing much. And Tom Cruise is waving his arms and shouting and acting his heart out. And Nicholson doesn't have to do anything and he wins the scene. And that is all of Heat to me, where you have De Niro just doing nothing. And Al Pacino going, "Give me all you got!" And I mean, again, I understand that that's part of the character. And they go with this larger-than-life cop. But I think Al Pacino comes off looking so bad, particularly in relation to Robert De Niro.
I'm glad you went there next, because that's sort of where I was going to steer the conversation. Because for me, it's not really about who comes off like as better or gives a better performance, though I guess I would agree. I think De Niro is a little bit better. But for me, I just think it's a fascinating excerpt of both of their careers, because as you intimated, like, it is a microcosm of their whole of like what their legacies will be right here in this movie occurring at the same time. And I mean, that's, and I mean, obviously, you know,
in what way though?
Well, like, just, I mean, how we've come to know, like, when you think of Al Pacino, you think of him doing the things that he's doing in this movie.
I know, but even that didn't really start until like Scent of a Woman, because
no, I know,
you go
yeah,
back to the Godfather and Michael Corleone has a lot more in common with Neil McCauley than he does with fucking Vincent Hanna. Like, it's almost sad to see what Al Pacino has become.
I guess that's true. I mean, there's a lot of that going on, like Dog Day Afternoon and stuff too. But like, I guess, Scent of a Woman is the advent of the screaming a lot and for not really good reason.
Right. Somebody just, I need to look it up. One of our listeners, I want to say it was Gray Weirdo, he goes under the name, in the comment section at our site. suggested for the F This Movie glossary a term called hoo-ha, where an actor develops horrible habits and then their career becomes defined by those habits. It's Nicholson post The Shining. It's Al Pacino post Scent of a Woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, because although here's something, and I don't know if you're aware of this, watching some of the special features on the Blu-ray of Heat, in one of the interviews, Al Pacino reveals that while it's never in the script, it's never talked about on screen.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to say, but I'll let you go ahead.
That he played the character as though he was chipping cocaine the entire movie.
Yeah. I've read that too. I thought he said it was like in an early draft of the screenplay or something, though. I don't know.
I mean, in the interview that he gives, he says that it's not talked about in the movie, but that that's the way he approached the character. And it's like, okay, well, I guess that makes more sense, but I think that has to be included then, because otherwise you're just giving this ridiculous performance, you know?
Yeah,
without any context. Like, if we know that you're high on cocaine, then it's like, okay, I sort of get it. But otherwise, you're just being crazy orange Al Pacino.
Yeah, I think that that is a case of you really threw me off the game there with the orange comment. That's a case of like creative people creating past one another, I think.
Right.
But it's funny now. It's a gray weird. Like, and I did I miss? Do you not remember the term that Gray Weirdo had put forth?
I believe it was hua.
Oh, hua. Oh, okay. Yeah. Just as that. Okay. Because it's funny that while I agree that this is like, for, you know, this is Al Pacino's, you know, bad leg. I mean, you can never undo Godfather 1 and 2, but like, you know, I mean, I understand that this is sort of what he's devolved into, but I think you could also make the argument that like De Niro has, and not that he's really he's good in Heat. Like, he is giving a good performance in Heat, but I mean, I think his legacy is of just sort of being sort of absentee and phoning things in.
Yeah.
Which is sort of the opposite of what Pacino does. So in that way, that's what I meant before when I was like, just as all I mean by that is guys who are, you know, one guy is too oversimplify, I guess.
Right. One guy is cold and top. Right. One guy is distant and aloof, and one guy is.
And I fully acknowledge that, yeah, Pacino wasn't always like that, but he's certainly been more of that. I don't know.
Right. And I guess, you know, Heat is probably the best version of that, because the movie establishes a universe where such a thing is possible and where it's trying to examine sort of these different kinds of hyper masculinity. And he certainly presents a different side of that. You know, I don't hate his performance in Heat. I think it's ridiculous, but again, it's one of those things that I say, yeah, whatever, it's Heat. Like, it's just part of this crazy mix that is this movie that overreaches.
Yes.
That does a lot of things great. But I don't, and I don't even totally mind the overreaching, you know. This movie could probably lose an hour.
Sure. Oh, and, yeah, easy.
And it would probably still be a great movie, but like, it wouldn't be the movie that it is that I kind of love. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I kind of love the weird tangents that it takes with the Natalie Portman stuff with her dad, and she's trying to kill herself. Like, what? Or like Val Kilmer's gambling addiction and his home life with Ashley Judd, who, by the way, all right, so Michael Mann is famous for putting great actors in literally every single part. I mean, look at in Collateral, in the first like 5 minutes, Tom Cruise walks into an airport and does an exchange, right, with Jason Statham, who has maybe one line, maybe two, and that's it. And you're like, holy shit, that's Jason Statham. And that's the last you see of him.
Yep. And Javier Bardem is in that, too. And
right.
Like,
he's got the
like
one
Javier
scene.
Bardem.
Exactly, right. So he fills the movies with these great actors. And man, nowhere is that more true than in Heat. I mean, every single person that comes on screen is like, I know that guy. And
that's
sometimes
part of the fun. I mean, that is part of the fun of Heat, and that's why that is always what I enjoy when I go back to it.
Definitely. What's
never is that truer than random Jeremy Piven sighting as the like crooked doctor.
Still,
oh my god.
Still bald, sporting a mustache, maybe because he thinks that makes him look older. It's like, oh, there's Hank Azaria as the asshole boyfriend, and is Henry Rollins playing the security guard? Like, this is crazy. What's
sure
going on?
Is. He
right.
Sure is.
Every single person in the movie is somebody, and I would argue every single person in the movie is good. I mean, Tom Sizemore went crazy, but he's great in the movie.
This was his wheelhouse in the mid and late 90s. Yeah, I mean, definitely. He is good in it, but I mean, this is how he made his bucks at that.
Right.
At that time. And well, not even just in his total career, not just the mid and late 90s. I mean, for the entirety of his career and his real life.
Everyone is good, with the exception, I would argue, of Ashley Judd. And now, I have never been what you would call a fan of Ashley Judd. I've always felt she attempts to be intense, but her intensity is always weirdly at odds with the material. And sometimes she tries to be soft, and that doesn't quite work. I'm just not really an Ashley Judd fan.
Yeah, now, no, I'd agree. I mean, if you put me on the spot and said, name, like, the definitive Ashley Judd moment, I mean, I guess it's Kiss the Girls, but I don't know.
Double Jeopardy, I think, is the movie that fundamentally misunderstands the law. So she's in the movie, and again, she's doing this sort of intense thing because everybody in the movie is super intense, but like she's really bad and has this laughable line. I'm trying to remember exactly what it is. It's like, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it.
Oh, and yeah. Yeah, yeah.
When
De Niro comes and confronts her about stepping out on Val Kilmer.
I could roll it back and listen to it 100 times, and I'm convinced that somehow she's channeling Kristen Wiig in the future, like Kristen Wiig playing a 30s actress. You know what I mean? Like, man, there's so many weird levels of why bad line delivery, but I love it. It's right. Again, there's several of those in the movie, most of them courtesy of Al Pacino. I was fascinated, too, that, like, Michael Mann, for as much as he tries to understand everything, he wants to understand the psychology of the criminal as well as the cop. He tries to understand the way that all of these things are laid out. But there's a scene where Pacino, who, of course, has to be shown as being down with all of the black people. He goes to visit, like, the black dance club.
Yeah.
And they're dancing to Top of the Morning to You by House of Pain. And I'm like, Michael Mann, you didn't do all of your research, because no way are they dancing to House of Pain at this club.
Well, when you're conducting rigorous interviews with cops and criminals, you have to skimp somewhere else, I guess.
Well, but, yeah. Surely you got to hire a music supervisor to take care of these things.
I mean,
things.
You got
Come
Tone
on.
Loke right there. I mean, no, I'm exactly. Sure he can help you out. Yeah.
Put on some funky cold Medina. That I can buy. Not House of Pain. Come on.
No. That's true. You know, it's funny that you talked earlier about how Heat is very dutiful to like tackling the psychology of these men. And I'm reminded of the great words of Donald Kaufman, who says that, you know, you explore the notion that cop and criminal are two sides of the same person. See every cop movie for other examples of this. And while that's true, like this is why I keep coming back to Heat. Like there is not like. I don't think that there's anything terribly original from a storytelling perspective in Heat, like troubled cops who like dive into their jobs for and at the expense of their personal lives.
Right.
And, you know, career criminals who have no attachments to anything and, you know, will give anybody, you know, that's like this is it's well-worn territory. But it's executed, as you said, this goes back to his technical expertise, it's executed so well that like. I mean, how dare you, anybody, for, like, saying, well, Heat isn't original, so I don't like it. I mean, that is so beyond the point. Like, I mean, these are just well-established tropes, and he's saying, I'm running with them, and I will tell, like, the definitive story, you know.
Yeah, right. He's not necessarily trying to make a new Cops and Robbers movie.
No.
He's trying to make every Cops and Robbers movie, at the same time. It's like, this is the culmination of every crime movie that's ever come out. You know, the tagline for Heat actually back when it came out in 95 was, it was on the poster. It just said an LA crime saga. And it's like, that's super pretentious. Right. But it also is very accurate in terms
in
describing the movie's intentions. I want to talk a little bit about the streak of misogyny that runs through Heat. And again, the movie is very much about men and the way that men think and work and act and interact with one another. And I understand that. So I'm not taking the movie to task for not having better developed female characters. Michael Mann is allowed to make a movie that focuses on men. The problem is...
He's done it before and he'll do it again.
Absolutely. The problem is that it introduces a lot of female characters, and what it has to say about them is not great. You look at the Natalie Portman character, which, again, it's weird that she's even in the movie, but it's fun to see her young and talented, and you're like, hey, she's going to win an Oscar for making out with Mila Kunis. That's the only character, I think, where this notion that I think is part of what's at the heart of the movie is really elaborated at all, which is that women, in general, the loved ones of these men, are ruined by men. You know, that she is psychologically destroyed, not by a character that we ever even really see on screen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
By her father. And it's this notion that, like, these guys are not here for their loved ones, and it ruins them. It drives her to try and kill herself. It devastates her psychologically. I mean, even in her first scene, she's freaking out about, I can't find my earrings or something.
Barrettes,
yes. So while, again, it doesn't totally belong in the movie, I think that what it has to say is kind of smart and accurate in terms of what's going on in the movie. Otherwise, unfortunately, as much as the movie wants to suggest that is the case with all of the female relationships, almost to a person, every man in the movie is brought down by a woman, whether it's Val Kilmer or Robert De Niro, I had another example of this.
Val Kilmer gets away, though.
Sure.
And actually, I find that little moment that they share.
No, I do kind of like that. I do
kind of noble.
Right. I do kind of like that.
I think it's very true of the two main characters. Like, I definitely understand that. And furthermore,
and they're all cheaters. Like, all these women cheat.
Oh yeah.
Including Ashley Judd, including Diane Venora. It's also hinted at in the special features that while Val Kilmer was possibly in prison, that his character was in prison, that the Ashley Judd character was prostituting herself.
Wait, that was intimated where?
In some of the special features, I think, on the Blu-ray, okay. Or possibly on Michael Mann's commentary track. And again, I appreciate a movie that comes up with a backstory for some of these relationships, but when only bits and pieces of it sort of leak their way out into the movie without really clarifying, I mean, if that knowledge somehow informs their dynamic, okay, but without you understanding that in the audience, you don't get what's going on between them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this to me is the ultimate allure of Heat, because for as long as it is and for as how much stuff there is in it, here we are on this podcast saying, you know what, we could have used some more of this. Like, I mean, we need a scene where Vincent Hanna, like, just like freebases cocaine, and then things will make sense.
And then we'll understand why he's doing these things that he's doing.
No, I got it. And I'm totally with you. And I'll go even more so than... I agree with your point that, you know, the men are largely ruined by women. Mm-hmm. I would even go a step further in that the women are actually like, and again, I'm speaking mostly of the De Niro and Pacino characters. Like, the whole like thesis of the movie is that like these men are supposed to do these jobs. That is what they were like,
right?
You know, whatever, designed by God or nature or whoever,
right,
to do these tasks. And it's almost as though the women are like, all they're doing is like keeping them from this stuff.
Yes, like, yes, absolutely.
It's like the women are like an inconvenience or something.
Absolutely. Yes, you're absolutely
like,
right.
It's so like the notion of developing an emotional relationship with somebody is like an obstacle or something, like, you know, and that's right. That is what,
or
is
in the
more...
case of Robert De Niro, it's your downfall, it's your death, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, he waits too long, you know.
And that's part of the problem too that I have again with Heat, and I don't mind it because it's Heat and I just like it, but you know, you get that incredible sequence at around the hour 45 mark the bank robbery, the set piece that's in the middle of the movie. And that's what I was going to say, that, like, why do people talk about that diner scene? They should be talking about that bank robbery scene, because it's crazy.
I mean, people talk about that too.
Definitely. But, yes. Even like when The Town came out a couple years ago, there were a lot of comparisons to Heat, because it's just like, oh, Heat, that's the one to top, you know? And It's funny because it's a sequence that we've seen in a lot of other movies. Heat's innovation is that it gives everyone machine guns.
I know.
Because while I was watching it last night, I was like, okay, this scene would still be good, because Michael Mann is a super talented director, and the scene would still be good if they were just firing pistols at each other, you know? But the fact that every character has a fucking machine, the cops, the bank robbers, everyone has a machine gun, just makes it so much more intense and dangerous and loud. I remember seeing this movie in the theater, and I could not believe how loud the gunfire was.
I'm jealous. I mean, you mentioned that you watched this on Blu-ray. I did not watch this on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I can only imagine the quality. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's staged in a way that, like, allows the already loud gunfire to, like, amplify and echo off of the buildings,
right,
and like
right.
every shot.
There's no music,
like,
you know, it's like,
yeah, no music. Yeah. It's all that. It, you know, it radiates in your sternum when you're watching.
Yeah. It's great. But so you have that set piece, right? And then there's still another hour left in the movie. And
I know,
I won't suggest that like that hour needed to go, but that's where things get a little tricky for me, because the movie only extends because characters keep making the wrong decisions. And I understand that's part of what Heat is trying to say, that Robert De Niro's judgment is clouded by emotion for the first time ever. He makes mistakes because he got emotionally attached to certain things. Okay, but like, as good as De Niro is in the movie, and as much as I like the Neil McCauley character, because I really do, I think those moments aren't earned. Like, I think it becomes a function of the screenplay instead of something that I believe. I think that when he makes some of those choices, that the movie betrays what we've come to know about Neil McCauley.
I think of that. I mean, I'm thinking of one specific moment, and that is when they are in the car and John Voight, the gloriously mulleted John Boyd, has
playing Eddie Bunker, basically.
Oh man, I can't believe we got this far and didn't talk about him yet.
What about fucking Tom Noonan on the porch, just being weird for the sake of being weird? Just...
I love it. I fucking love this movie so much. Anyway, when John Boyd has arranged for his new getaway, and he's driving in the car with Amy Brenneman. And, you know, like, and God bless De Niro, like, you can see him trying to sell it. Like, you know, he's got his hands on the wheel, and he's doing that contemplative De Niro stuff. And then he decides he has to go back for Kevin Gage, which totally runs counter to his whole, like, I'll walk away from this in 30 seconds if I...
Exactly.
Like, that is
going back for Kevin Gage, going back for William Fichtner, even to some extent going back for Amy Brenneman, which... I'll cut the movie a little bit of slack, because that's his arc, right? He finds love, and it's his downfall. So, okay. But yeah, it's going back for Wayne Grow and William Fichtner that, to me, betrays the character.
Yeah, and having said that, and I was thinking about this, like, I mean, having said that, I don't quite buy all those choices. Mm-hmm. Like, the absence of those choices would give us an ending that I don't think is as good as the one we get. And I don't know. I mean, maybe, I don't know. Maybe Michael Mann could pull that off. But I really do love the ending of the movie, even if I question how it got there. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm sort of being contradictory, because I love what I get, but I don't like how we got there, which is sort of nitpicky, and goes back to this goes back to the point of like why we love Heat and we forgive what's wrong with it. Like, I mean, we love how it plays as a whole piece. Do you understand what I'm saying there? Like, I mean,
I do. Yeah.
Is the ending satisfying for you? Because I really love the ending of this movie.
Okay, now you're talking about the shootout at the airport?
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure exactly what you meant. I think it's okay. I think it's an interesting way to stage that sequence. I like the idea of each time the lights from the runway come up, it gives away a location or whatever. You know, I think that's kind of interesting. I don't love it, and I think part of the problem is that it just feels a little anticlimactic.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because anything would coming off of that bank robbery sequence.
That's the point you were making before.
Right. I think it's a little bit, again, it's a little bit too much. What just happened? A little bit too much a function of a plot that needs to get these two guys completely alone, one-on-one with each other. The movie tries to have it both ways, where it tries to be very realistic and true to life and obsessed with real life detail. Mm-hmm. But it also wants to be this big operatic crime saga. And the ending, to me, is more interested in being the operatic crime saga than it is in being a more realistic way of getting these two guys to have a showdown with one another, if that makes any sense. I'm okay with it. I understand that it's satisfying. I understand that ultimately these two guys have to come to blows or, you know, have a confrontation with one another, and one of them, only one of them, can walk away a winner. There's so many other scenarios that I can picture in my head as a way of getting to that same moment that doesn't feel as contrived.
Yeah. I've always sort of liked, I realize that I'm sort of contradicting what I just said about the certain decisions that are made, and I fully admit that before I even go further, but when he gets to the hotel, like, mm-hmm. that's to finish off Wangro. Like, I've already, like, had my beef with going there in the first place. But when he is already there, like, I am kind of over that. And at that point, first of all, I love the visual device of Amy Brenneman sitting behind the hotel in the car. And he says, "I'll be right back." And she remains in the car and, like, I mean, he pulls a fire alarm, and that's why it happens. But I just love the visual of, like, the shot of her in the car. She's initially by herself, and then, of course, eventually all of this chaos just starts building up all around her. There's, you know, emergency service vehicles all around, right. And she's so scared and looking around. I think it's a great little summation of, like, what this man actually means in her life.
Right, right, right.
Like, it's. I mean, she is better off for not for him having walked away, and I think that that's a really great device. I got a little off track there. My point is that you just said you felt this was contrived, but I've always really loved how everything kind of falls away and it literally just comes to him, like, chasing him on foot with a shotgun, like, across a tarmac. I mean, everything is sort of like the whole thing was this big plan. And I like that when things go wrong, they go way wrong.
Yeah.
And it's like he's literally like, and this is what I was saying at the beginning about the stakes being high.
Mm-hmm.
And that in that moment when he's pursuing him, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, anything could happen. And I'm not saying just because something is surprising to you or just because something, we've talked about this in the context of, like, movies that have twists. This is not one of those movies, but, like, just because something is up in the air in the last 5 minutes doesn't necessarily mean that it's good, but it helps for me, I guess.
I give the movie some credit too for killing off the De Niro character, because I can picture a lot of versions of this movie in which we get to the end and the screenwriter or the filmmaker or the studio at some point, somebody says, "Listen, we like this guy, and isn't there a way for him to get away while still having, like, sort of the cop, to have them both win, in a sense." I don't know what that means for the cop, that he allows the guy to get away, so we're okay with it because it's a choice that he made, or that the cop brings down everybody else, or, you know, some version of, can't they both win?
This is sort of like what happens in Mystic River, isn't it?
Oh, God, what the hell is the end of Mystic River?
The only thing I remember about the end of Mystic River is that when it was done, I said, "Wait a minute, the cop doesn't care." so that's a little different. I don't know. I haven't seen Mystic River in a while.
And what is the deal with how did Mystic River cast a spell over me? Because I saw it, and I was like, "That was good." And then every time I thought about Mystic River ever since, I'm like, "That movie is ridiculous."
No. I don't know. I don't know what the spell was. But I don't like Mystic River.
Tim Robbins becomes a criminal genius in the span of one scene. He's such a simpleton for the whole movie, and then all of a sudden he's like, "Could I get a Sprite?" And he turns into Hannibal Lecter. Anyway.
Yeah, no, but as I recall, like, that movie, that is a movie that at least sort of tries to have it both ways.
Right, right. Yeah. So I give the movie a little bit of credit for not trying to romanticize too much the De Niro character. Although, I mean, I guess it does, even in the way that he's killed and he gets this little moment with, you know, Pacino or whatever.
I'm glad you reminded me, for as much as I love the ending and I just praised it to no end, I don't like that. That is a scene that needs to have no dialogue at the end of it. And yeah. he has a totally unnecessary line. He says, "I told you I wasn't going back." Like that doesn't need to be there. Like,
we understood that.
You don't have to say the thing that we're all thinking. You literally ran like as far as you could run and right. then got shot. Like we got it. Yeah.
Right. But. Right. Right. And you know, again, some of that is to put the audience's mind, I think, a little bit at ease, where it's like, oh no, De Niro's okay with dying. And if somebody's going to do it, he's glad it's Pacino. Cause he has his respect, you know, like, there's a lot going on in that moment that I think in some ways is for the audience's peace of mind. But again, these are, you know, I really could sit here and like nitpick Heat all day. But when I'm watching it, most of that goes away, because even though I register problems and every time Ashley Judd says, I'm sick of it. I'm definitely pulled out of the movie for 1.5 seconds. But like for the most part, I'm just like, no, it needs to be this crazy.
That's what I'm saying. Mess, like it's all part of the charm. Even right? the bad things. Yes. I'm obsessed with this phenomenon. That's not exclusive to Heat. There are lots of movies that we've even talked about on the podcast that are like this. But I think that's just the trademark of like bold ambition paying off. In that, like, I mean, if I can oversimplify the phenomena that leads us to look past these things.
Right. I'm trying to think though of another movie that. Because I know the movie that you're talking about, and I am forever on this podcast talking about The Ambitious Failure, and Heat is not an ambitious failure. I think Heat is an ambitious success with things about it that fail. But there are definitely movies that like I was just emailing a little bit with Eric Asperschlager, who's on our show, because he's writing a review of Cameron Crowe's We Bought a Zoo.
Okay.
For DVD Verdict at DVDverdict.com. And I talked about the movie a little bit at the end of 2011. I saw it. There are things in that movie that make me cringe so badly that I think are so terrible that I can't believe they're still in a movie in 2011, right? But the moments that work in that movie, and I do think there are things in the movie that work, carry me through all the bad stuff. So I walk away just remembering the good stuff, right? But I definitely could have done without the terrible stuff. I'm trying to think of another movie that there's stuff in it that doesn't work, but that I still want it in there the way that I do with Heat. You know what I mean?
I feel differently, and maybe this is the point you were just making, and I want to make sure. Like, I don't think you feel the same way about We Bought a Zoo that you do about Heat. Like,
no, definitely not.
We Bought a Zoo. Oh, okay, good. I'm just making sure. You table the bad.
I'm just trying to think of a movie that like I like that has a lot of bad stuff in it. And I like it in spite of the bad stuff. Whereas with Heat, it's like
I embrace.
I take the good, I take the bad, I take them both, and there I have the facts of Heat.
Maybe we can leave that as an open discussion for that, because I can't think of anything right now either. Although I'm sure an example exists.
Yeah, it's like I wouldn't know if they got rid of all the crazy stuff, all the subplots and weird tertiary characters. And
maybe it all falls apart. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that it falls apart, but it's not the same movie like, you know, like, and now I can sit there and wait for the scene where Al Pacino is like, "You got a great ass."
I'm going to watch it again.
Anyway, thanks for talking about Heat. And
Hey, thanks for having me. It's terrific.
Yeah. This was fun. And everybody remember, you can find us at fthismovie.blogspot.com, and you can email us your thoughts on Heat at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Alex, do you want to take us out?
I sure do. And because I botched it the first time, I am not shameful about bringing it back. Because fuck you, Joe Boo. I do it myself.